Everyone, we now convene our Thursday, April 28, 2005 session of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Human Services. We'll be dealing with public hearing on House Bill 5038, which is the Department of Human Services Senior and People with Disabilities. And for an overview, Mr. Britton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Before I start talking and giving you somewhat of an overview, I want to mention a couple of things. There are a number of handouts that we distributed this morning. There is a copy of my summary here that we gave you. There is a copy of the governor's recommended budget sheets from Ms. Teschner, Budget and Management Division, that she'll be reviewing in a moment. There is also some further budget data from the Department, Seniors and People with Disabilities, that provide some breakdown, a little more detail of the different programs within Seniors and People with Disabilities. And we'll be working from these sheets this morning along with the budget presentation book. I also want to mention that tentatively we have scheduled public testimony on the Seniors and People with Disabilities budget next Tuesday and Wednesday. My colleague asked me yesterday if we should divide that between programs for persons with developmental disabilities and seniors and people with other physical disabilities. We've not done that, and that may cause more confusion, but I think we're planning on having 2 days. Not everyone has to get in the first day. We'll have a whole second day to do more public testimony. But that is right now scheduled for Tuesday and Wednesday next week. With that, I would turn to the written material that I provided you that provides an overview of this Seniors and People with Disabilities budget. The Cluster's mission, as I've laid it out here, assisting seniors and people with disabilities of all ages to achieve well-being through opportunities for community living, employment, family support, and services that promote choice, independence, and dignity. The budget is about $2.2 billion total funds, $728.7 million general fund, and it supports four main program components: Medicaid long-term care and other components within that of long-term care. This program, by and large, operates under several Medicaid waivers. It provides long-term care services, assisted living, nursing facility care, adult foster home, and in-home care to seniors and people with physical and developmental disabilities. And it is a cluster that, in the departmental reorganization, was put together really with two main components, that of the seniors and people with physical disabilities, and another one which used to be separate, services to persons with developmental disabilities. There is also, as I've noted here, the Eastern Oregon Training Center, which is the state's intermediate care facility. And this particular program's budget is about 82% of the entire cluster budget. There is also within this cluster Older Americans Act, exclusively federal funds, $26.7 million. DHS is the state administrator of the federal Older Americans Act, and the funds are distributed to local area agencies on aging, which deliver a variety of services, including information and referral, transportation, meals on wheels, congregate meals, and senior employment programs. Next program within SPD, direct financial support. This is the Oregon Supplemental Income Program. And these are supplemental income payments made to persons who receive Supplemental Security Income, SSI. The remaining portion of the budget, $372 million total funds, is used to fund central administration, the Disability Determination Services Program, which adjudicates eligibility for SSI and also Social Security disability income. It's exclusively federally funded. Licensing and regulatory staff, and most significantly, the field staff that provide case management services. And it's important to note that the field staff here that we're talking about includes both state employees as well as Area Agency on Aging employees, nonprofit brokerage staff that provide services with respect to for persons with developmental disabilities, and also some county employees. The next portion that I have written about here, the major policy and budget issues, was for me the hardest part to write because there are a number of issues related to this particular area. And I've really put down two bullets, but there are a lot of sub-themes, if you will. Maintaining the integrity of the long-term care system over the next 5 to 7 years. There is uncertain impact of the Medicare Modernization Act. I've sat in on several meetings with program managers and budget staff on this particular issue. There is concern that the Medicare Modernization Act could lead to significant increases in caseload, and we'll be talking about that a little bit later. Provider costs and reimbursement. As long as I've been working on this budget, this is always an issue, and those of you who have worked on this know that to be the case. Adults and persons with physical disabilities have, to a greater degree, a private pay market for services. Services for persons with developmental disabilities have largely been the result of governmental funding and capacity building. And it's just to say that when we talk about provider reimbursement and keeping the market alive and going, or having enough capacity within the developmental disability services arena, that reimbursement and costs obviously are very significant. We've also seen assisted living, the cuts proposed in the governor's budget to those rates. We've seen increased costs related to the home care worker component of this program. So in any case, we always are hit with provider costs and reimbursement issues. Funding for prevention versus treatment. This is certainly not unique to the seniors and people with disabilities cluster. It's a theme that hits every aspect of the Department of Human Services. That is, in terms of allocating funding, how much do you put in terms of prevention, preventing more serious difficulties, and how much do you put in with respect to treating disabilities and problems that have occurred after the fact? And typically, when there is a budget shortfall, we tend to cut preventive services. That's the most typical budgetary response, but it may have some long-term impacts. Integrating long-term care with acute care. Many times we think of the Oregon Health Plan, which is a Medicaid program, and the Seniors and People with Disabilities program independently, and they are not. When a person is eligible for Medicaid long-term care, they are also eligible for the Oregon Health Plan, and these two programs need to work more closely together. There have been attempts on the department's behalf to get that to happen, but the real issue is that people need physical, mental, emotional, social supports to live independently, and coordinating of these programs is a key factor. I've listed federal Medicaid financing reform. The president's budget made some proposals along these areas to provider taxes, and they are facing budgetary issues just like the state of Oregon. And this leads me to the second bullet point, preparing for the future. The aging and increasing disability of the baby boomers and the financial sustainability of the Medicaid long-term care program. I've attached one title page to my analysis here. It was a report that was issued in March of 2002. It's testimony of David M. Walker, Comptroller General of the United States. Coincidentally, after I had printed this yesterday, an almost identical testimony came out from the General Accountability Office statement of Catherine Allen, Director of Healthcare, Medicaid, and Private Health Insurance Issues.
What was
that? That testimony just included the title page. It didn't give you the whole report. But some of the highlights of that report: of all the funding sources for long-term care in the United States in 2003, Medicaid picked up about almost half, 48% of those costs, about $87 billion. And this isn't obviously just in Oregon. It's for the whole United States. There were remarks in Ms. Allen's testimony: absent reform, spending for Medicaid, Medicare, and Social Security will put unsustainable pressure on the federal budget. The elderly population — this does not include persons specifically with disabilities, but the elderly population in 2000 was estimated at about 34, 35 million persons, 65 and older. Of that, 4.3 million are 85 and older. By the year 2040, that population, the 85 and older, will rise, according to their estimates, to 15.4 million people, more than triple where it is today. So the demographics here point to some real significant changes with respect to our society. This is the context we're looking at for this budget for the next 2 years, but down the road, 20, 30, 40 years down the road. Anyway, that testimony also includes cost estimates. And I would leave it to you and your staff. You're welcome to get a copy of the report from me. It is GAO report 05564T, and it was issued yesterday. All this is to say that we have some long-term planning issues for these services if we're to keep up with the needs of the persons and also keep a budget going here. Budget notes, emergency board actions, and audit findings. House Bill 5030 of 2003, which is the primary budget bill for the Department of Human Services, included four budget notes related to the SPD budget cluster. And the text of those budget notes are included in the department's budget books, not the budget presentation books, but the actual budget books. I've summarized them here. One of the notes directed DHS to report to the emergency board if the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services denied a request to fund services to persons in survival priority levels 12 and 13. As it turned out, CMS did not deny that request, and those survival priority levels are funded today. Another note directed DHS to examine its client assessment process and service priority level regulations with respect to Medicaid long-term care. And this morning, there were inserts put in many of your budget presentation books. If your books weren't here, they are lying next to your other handouts. But there's a report from the department on its efforts to comply with that particular budget note. Two final budget notes direct to DHS to obtain documentation from area agencies on aging concerning the Oregon Project independence fees they collect, and to work with the AAAs to determine whether certain uses of OPI could be eligible for Medicaid reimbursement. And during the biennium, the department did report on both of those efforts. With respect to the emergency board SPD had a minimal number of reports and grant requests. I've noted, however, that the SPD budget was significantly modified through departmental rebalance requests in April and November of 2004. The 2003-05 adopted budget included $782 million of general fund. This was the budget that had been set for this cluster as we left the 2003 session. And through the course of rebalances and the House Bill 5077 disappropriation in May 2004, the 2003-05 budget now stands at about $739 million of general fund, a decrease of over $40 million of general fund compared to the adopted budget. The decrease is the result of a lot of different things, a variety of factors, revised estimates of other funds' revenue, Medicaid match rate changes, caseload changes, lower than budgeted costs for programs for persons with developmental disabilities. And when we get to the departmental rebalance, that this budget will be modified yet again. There were no audits during the 2003-05 biennium conducted by the Secretary of State, but the Secretary of State did issue two management letters that dealt with area agencies on aging, and those letters are attached to my memorandum. Two audits related to SPD are currently in the planning stages. One will focus on Medicaid provider payments, and the other will focus on the Children's Intensive In-Home Services Program. Revenue sources, in addition, obviously, to general fund, SPD includes a significant amount of federal Medicaid revenue, matched at the program ratio of roughly 40% state funds to 60% federal funds, as well as the administrative match rate of 50-50. In addition, the budget includes $26.7 million of federal Older Americans Act revenue. Other funds revenue includes client contributions for Medicaid long-term care in-home services and estate recoveries. General fund represents about 33% of the cluster's revenue. The governor's recommended budget is $2.2 billion. It's about the same as the 2003-05 legislatively approved budget following the November 2004 rebalance. The governor's budget reflects reductions from the 2005-07 estimated cost of providing existing programs, current service level, that total nearly $200 million, $88 million of general fund. So in the governor's budget, this particular budget with respect to current service level was reduced by about $88 million general fund. The reductions include eliminating foster care for seniors and persons with disabilities that is provided by their relatives. It eliminates Oregon Project Independence. It eliminates the General Assistance Program. It eliminates a cost of living adjustment for service providers who offer care under the Staley Settlement Agreement. It scales back significantly assisted living facility rates. It proposes to restructure the in-home care worker program, and it imposes a lower waiver cap on home and community-based care programs for seniors and people with physical disabilities. The governor's budget includes an additional $2.1 million general fund to accommodate some of the impact of the Medicare Modernization Act, namely the reduction in client contributions because of higher prescription drug costs for them under the MMA, and three additional staff. As I said, I've included some attachments. The first is the LFO detailed analysis of the governor's budget, which most of you have already seen, but there's another copy for you. The two management letters I mentioned from the Oregon Secretary of State, and finally the title page of David M. Walker's testimony before the Special Committee on Aging Long-Term Care. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'll turn it back to you.
Thank you. Any questions on this review, the overview? I would like to welcome Representative Buckley to be joining our panel today. And why don't we go ahead and get started on our phase two for seniors and people with disabilities and invite Pam Teschner and Jim Taves to come forward.
Mr. Chair, we'll be working initially from this handout from Ms. Teschner.
Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee. My name is Pam Teschner with the Department of Administrative Services, and John just pointed out the handout that I'm going to be working from, so I want to make sure that you have that. You have seen this, these first few pages, a number of times already, so I'm not going to dwell on those in the prior clusters. This just sets, page two just sets the context of the department in comparison to the entire program area. And page three identifies the governor's principle that this fits into. The fourth page, again, you've seen this one too, for the other clusters. This just identifies how big of a piece that this particular cluster has in the department. Almost a quarter of the budget, total funds budget, is in seniors and people with disabilities. John went over the major areas within this cluster, and I just want to highlight that about 82% of those dollars are in long-term care, and as you have on the your handout from John, it's about $1.8 billion. The long-term care represents a continuum of services from in-home care to community-based settings to institutional settings. The $1.8 billion, about half of that is in community-based care. The next page, page five, just shows how the total funds split out. As you can see, a very large portion is federal funds. Most of that, over $1 billion of that, is Medicaid. But there's also some federal money coming in through the Older Americans Act as well as Social Security Act funds. Page six, this is how the total funds budget breaks out by category. And you're probably familiar now with the fact that the majority of the budgets in DHS are special payments. Most of the money goes out to providers in the long-term care system specifically. Page 7 lays out the history of this budget. One difference in this than what John has talked about and what you've seen in LFO analyses is that our 0305 legislatively approved number does not include November e-board, so you won't be able to match back to what John has provided you, but it does show the trend over time in this budget. And if you especially compare 0305 to 0507, you can see that there were some significant reductions in funding and in positions. This page 8 begins to step into the more significant budget drivers and major policy issues. And as John talked about the testimony that's just come out from GAO, obviously you've heard this many times, but one of the biggest issues that this system needs to is facing and needs to address is the aging population, the growing elderly population, placing increased demand on this long-term care system, and how what we need to do as a state to address that in terms of sustainability. Another significant development in 2003 was with the home care workers, and I know James is going to be talking about that as well. And within the context of growing demand and diminishing resources, the governor's budget was developed based on two goals in this area, and one was to try to preserve that continuum of long-term care and maintain an infrastructure, and at the same time trying to minimize the impact on clients already receiving services. So the focus was more on how to control that gate of them coming into the system, trying to minimize impact on people currently there. So you'll see in the reductions on page 9 that these reductions reflect that. Again, these are just the major reductions. These certainly don't sum up to all of the reductions that this cluster has taken. And these, again, were what John just laid out for you, the elimination of relative foster care, a reduction in assisted living facility rates. And actually, the assisted living facility rates were dropped a little bit. The adult foster care rates were increased a little bit, and so they kind of came to a middle ground there. John mentioned that we eliminated Oregon Project Independence, and in fact, the dollars do add up to an elimination of that program. However, that was not intended, and we need to make an adjustment to bring that program back up to the MOE level. The Older Americans Act requires about $3.9 or about $4 million of...
Okay, since many people that are watching this may not know what MOE stands for...
I'm sorry, yes. MOE is Maintenance of Efforts. State funds are required in order to receive the federal funds. The state has to provide a certain amount of general fund in this particular program. So our intent is to restore, add $6.3 million back to that program. So the intent was not to eliminate, but to reduce it down to that maintenance of effort level. The fourth bullet there is, and again, reflects that we tried to maintain service to clients currently in the system, but to try to control those coming in. And so there was, one of the reductions was to set a cap on the home and community-based care system. And I believe that the date was the end of December of 2005 to hold that, the people in the system at that time to hold it there, and then starting in January of 2006 to try to control the incoming by putting new clients on a waiting list. And the last item there, in, as far as a major reduction, is the elimination of general assistance program. So with that, if you don't have any questions, I'll turn it over to James.
Are there any questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, James Taves from the Department of Human Services Senior and Disability Program.
James, by the way, I want to start off by thanking you and Cindy Becker and Vic Todd and others involved for providing the financial information that we requested earlier. And also, I'm hoping that you'll deal as we go through this with what was just brought out by Pam on page 7, where it shows that in 2001 to 2003, the total funds were $2,327,000,000 with full-time positions of 1,531 people, and the 2005-07 budget is $2,216,000,000. In other words, it's down $110 million, but at 1,921. In other words, we're coming down in funding by $110 million, but we're going up 400 employees. And so in the course of our discussion, I'd like to see how does that fit into the providing of services to people.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, we'll try to reconcile those numbers. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think John and Pam have set the context very well for the issues we face in the long-term care system. During phase one, I mentioned that one of the critical activities for this next biennium is developing a long-range plan for Oregon's long-term care system. And I know we've spoken to some of you about that, and the governor has directed us to pull together stakeholders and experts and really do a very thorough analysis of the future of our long-term care system. And I think one of the things that we will do initially to set the stage is actually do a gap analysis, is to take today's service system with its mix and match of costs and different programs and overlay on that the aging and disability demographics and just trend it out 15 or 20 years. And then do a different line that says if you can expect revenue growth of 5% a year or something of that, how much of the current system for the increased demographic we could buy 15 to 20 years from now. And I think we'll see a sharp discrepancy there, and that really will be the focus of the long-range plan, is how do we fill in that gap and how do we triage services for the people that we will have revenue to do that for. So it's going to be a daunting task, but it's obviously something that we have to do in Oregon, and, of course, we're hopeful that some reform efforts will happen at the federal level as well. What I'd like to do, Mr. Chairman, with the committee's indulgence, is go through parts of the Phase 2 materials and some of the issues and reductions in the governor's recommended budget. I'd also like to cover some of I think there were four program areas where you asked us in Phase 1 to come back with additional discussion where there were major discrepancies in the scoring on the prioritization list, so we're prepared to do that as well. And then finally, we'll work through the other questions that you just posed, as well as the additional spreadsheet on the programs and average costs and people served. So if that progression is okay, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to start on page 3 of Phase 2. And first of all, what I'd like to talk a little bit is about the directions, the policy directions and the reductions that we made last biennium that set the stage for the thinking and the policy directions for this biennium. In 2003-2005 and in the special sessions preceding that, there were a whole series of reductions in the senior and disability program. The area that had the most impact for then and for the future were the reductions in the service priority levels. We had actually at one point dropped, I think I described in Phase 1, we have 17 different levels whereby we assess people at their acuity or their needs in assistance in daily living skills. And we dropped levels 12 through 17 at one point in the reductions. Ultimately, the legislature then restored levels 12 and 13, and so levels 14 through 17 continue to be not included in the budget. On page 5, we tried to do an analysis of what actually happened to people after the reductions occurred. And, of course, that was a very chaotic period with thousands of people getting notices both on the Oregon Health Plan and in the long-term care area. And we knew there would be lots of puts and takes as that occurred, that people would shift to other programs. Some people would still be eligible for the Oregon Health Plan. Other people would be reassessed, come in at different impairment levels, and end up in some other part of the service system. So I think it's a bit telling to look at that and to see that of the total number of people that were terminated or received, I should say, received termination notices, a large number of them ultimately ended up somewhere else in the service system as well. That prompted the last legislature in one of the budget notes to have us go out and look at the service priority levels and whether those levels really captured people's needs. The concern was then, and I think it's still a concern now, that the assessments for service priority levels were originally created as a care planning tool. They were not originally created as real discrete tools to determine whether a person was eligible. I'm sorry.
Mr. Tava. Mr. Britton.
James, on the chart on page 5, I don't know if you're going to go over it in any detail, but could you do that? would you please go over the chart on page 5? I'm not clear on what this is showing here. So, and maybe you intended to do that anyway.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Britton, no, I didn't intend to do that, but be happy to spend a little bit of time on it. It describes, if you look at the top of page 5, in levels 15 through 17, we sent notices to 3,231 individuals saying they would be terminated from services. If you look at that chart, then levels 15 through 17, the totals across the bottom are the same. That was the total number of people that received notices. Then when you look at each of the dates there, it shows at that date in time, of those 3,231 individuals, where they then were either located or still served elsewhere in our service system. So if you look at February 03, of that total number, 1,071 were completely closed out, not showing up anywhere else in our service system. 419 were back in waiver services, 578 in personal care, 28 in nursing facilities, and so on. And then over 1,000 receiving Oregon Health Plan services, but not other long-term care services. So that's we tried to display, again, the shifts as all of those termination notices occurred. And the chart below essentially replicates that for levels 12 through 14.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Moss Henderson.
So these are all the same people? These 3,231 are the same individuals, and you're showing how they moved from these various areas?
Mr. Okay. Chairman, Senator, that's correct.
Thank you.
Would you explain on the nursing facility portion? And we have 3,231, and then in February, February through 9 or 10 months, 12 months later, it goes up from 28 to 46 individuals out of 3,200 that are in nursing facilities. How does that work? Did these people all qualify for services and therefore could have elected to go to nursing home, or were they requalified and elected to go to nursing home?
Mr. Chairman, I don't have an exact breakdown, but it would be a mixture of both. But certainly some of those individuals were located in nursing facilities at the time they received the termination notice, and then later upon reassessment or upon appeal, if they went through a full contested case hearing, they were deemed to be eligible. So they didn't actually relocate, but were deemed to be eligible after a termination notice originally went out. Some individuals could have actually then showed up at a higher impairment level later when they were reassessed and actually been admitted to a nursing facility.
Okay, but they would have had to have been reassessed anyway if they were at a 15 to 17, so they would have had to have been reassessed at 14 or lower.
Correct, Mr. Chairman.
For whatever reason, either stayed or elected to go to a nursing home?
Mr. Chairman, everyone who received termination notices had the right to be reassessed, and in fact, our case managers and field staff did do reassessments on virtually everybody.
Okay, thank you. Representative Henson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Of the cases that were closed, the 1,000 or so, was there follow-up information, any type of surveys and stuff in terms of what happened? I mean, did some of them, are they not receiving services because they died, or they relocated to another state, or is their families providing services, or do we know what happened to the closed cases?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, I know some of the area agencies actually did some follow-up, I don't know if I'd call them studies, but certainly tried to probe what happened to some of those individuals, and I think, again, it was a mixture of all the things you just said. There were some deaths. There were people that actually came and moved their aging parents to another state where they would still be eligible for services, and some people simply made do on their own. And again, the biggest cuts in one of the charts we looked at in phase one, the most precipitous reduction was in the in-home program. So in many cases, people at lower impairment levels were receiving some amount of hours in-home, and when that service was terminated, they have simply had to make do on their own.
Of the follow-up question, of the various studies or attempts by the various AAAs, did the department compile any kind of a collection of those or a review of them?
I don't believe we did, Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we have a lot of anecdotal information, but no, we didn't actually compile a formal type of study. We actually, Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, tried to partner at one point with the Institute on Aging at Portland State, and we're trying to secure a grant, and we really wanted to do a very detailed analysis of that group, but for a variety of reasons, that grant didn't come through.
Other questions? And there's a lot that we could ask, but why don't you go ahead and continue. Actually, there has to be one other question. That is on the second graph. It shows levels 12 to 14, which are more severe physical disabled than 15 to 17. And the first month, March 03, the waivered services went to 1,265. And so we have a large number that were approved as being, as still qualifying. But the following month, that went down to 590. And the closed cases went from 128 to 408. And so would you comment on what took place over the first few months for the level 12 to 14?
Mr. Chairman, I can't answer that off the top of my head, but I can certainly get that information.
Thank you. Let's continue.
Mr. Chairman, I was going to comment on, at the end of last session, one of the budget notes directed us to go out and to look at the service priority levels for exactly the kinds of questions you're asking now. There was great concern that there was so much fluctuation and changes in eligibility and changes in service settings because of that. And the concern was whether the service priority levels, which, again, are keyed off of assistance in daily living tasks, really were sufficient to measure a person's risk and whether they were sufficient as the foundation for eligibility into long-term care. We convened a large group during the interim, including many, many different agencies and advocates, and came out with a set of recommendations that said, if you look at the people in levels 14 through 17 who no longer are eligible based on ADLs, but if you then looked at additional risk criteria and if you were to expand services and reinstate some of those individuals, what would those risk criteria be? And in the full report, and I won't go through in any detail, but the highlights of that report were that for certain areas of mobility, cognition, certain medical diagnoses, and meal preparation activities, those risk areas can be measured pretty carefully. And if, in fact, you went beyond the current eligibility, there are ways that we could actually score risk in those areas and say, based on that, people in levels 14 through 17 who probably, if we don't intervene now, will ultimately come back in at lower impairment levels anyway, therefore it would be good to provide outreach and services to them now. So I think it was a very thorough report. We did some very rough costing of what the cost would be, and I think it's in the range of $20 million general fund if we were to add that group back in, and obviously that's not included in the proposed budget. Mr. Chairman, moving on, to talk about the governor's recommended budget and the reduction scenarios, I really would like to, just for 1 second, sort of describe the box that we are in as we approach this budget. It was the box that formed the choices we made last biennium, and in many ways it's the issues that we're going to have to deal with in the future of the system as well. We looked at all kinds of different scenarios in containing and or reducing the budget. As you know, last biennium we cut the levels. When we went back to the federal government and reinstated levels 12 and 13, and we had a full discussion in the emergency board before we did that, we were told we would absolutely have to assure the federal government that we would not reinstate these levels and then pull them right back out again. And essentially the feds were telling us you can't keep altering your basic criteria for a mandatory service, which is nursing home services. And of course, the eligibility for nursing home services is the same eligibility as it is for all of your home and community-based services. And they felt that that was inappropriate. Oregon could no longer do that. So in that sense, we were locked in and looking at level reductions again in the next cycle. We made several attempts last biennium to drop the income levels. We thought about it again in this budget where we would drop it from because our eligibility, like most states, goes to 300% of SSI, about $1,600 a month and $2,000 in assets. That's the financial eligibility. And we had made several proposals last biennium to drop that to 250 or 215% of SSI. We considered that again, but because of both federal law and a whole series of court cases that allow people to shelter income under income cap trusts, unless the state goes all the way down to 100% of SSI, which is $585 a month, something like that, you can't get there. And if we had done that, we would have declared ineligible nearly two-thirds of our entire long-term care system. So that was part of the box that we really couldn't look at. Then,
I have a question. The governor's proposal is to just cap it. In other words, you're going from 300 to zero for anybody above the cap. Was there consideration, or is it possible to go from the current 300 and cap and then go down to 100% after that date, so that the very poor could exceed the cap that is going, that the governor's proposing is going to be effective as of the end of this year.
Mr. Chairman, we've actually thought about situations like that, but the short answer is no. You can't create different caps within your overall eligibility. You can create a cap and put people on a waiting list. They're still eligible.
Right.
So in terms of financial eligibility and qualifying in levels 1 through 13, they're still eligible. But the federal government does allow you in fact, every home and community-based waiver has a cap. You have a numerical cap that you declare, these are the number of people that we're going to serve under the Medicaid waiver for this next biennium. Our cap and the caps in most states are always so high that virtually everybody who's eligible gets served. So, but you cannot go in and discreetly then create caps for either income or other sub-eligibility caps. We can, however, set risk criteria, and certainly as part of the risk criteria, we could say poverty, no other resources, person imminently being discharged from a hospital into a nursing home where we would have to pay a much higher cost. And those are exactly the kind of criteria that we will have to put in place to do a cap. But you can't use the cap to cap eligibility in and of itself.
Okay, well, that's a clarification by itself. The cap is not an absolute cap. The cap that's being proposed would be a cap with waivers or exceptions for these severe cases.
Mr. Chairman, that's absolutely correct. The cap, as we envisioned it, was never an intent to say, as of this date, nobody else gets into long-term care. Because, of course, the problem there is, if they're still eligible, they're eligible for the mandatory service, which is nursing home services. And if you suddenly just had everybody going into nursing homes, our budget would be completely out of control. So at a minimum, we have to look at people who are at most at risk of institutional placement, number one. And then there's a variety of other things. Of people that go into other programs, they spend down, they become Medicaid eligible. And we'll have to develop, and we're actually starting to work, and we're pulling a work group together that will look at exactly what those risk criteria are. The cap really will be more of staging the time a person gets in as opposed to excluding a person completely. So based on those at-risk criteria, probably people with real complex needs in levels 1 through 4, going through a hospital discharge straight into a nursing facility unless we intervene, those kind of cases we will probably deem as eligible, not as eligible, but entering the service system immediately, and others then will be pushed off for periods of time.
Okay, thank you, Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This committee and the legislature is being asked to weigh whether or not the cap should be created. What's on that criteria, I think, would be the most, at least for me, would probably be the most vital piece of information in terms of whether to implement a cap or not. And, you know, in light of the fact that the budget recommendations were probably made in November and we're approaching May, wouldn't it be appropriate that even if you haven't finalized what that criteria is, that we should be, that the people that have to judge whether or not to have a cap should be shared the information of what the criteria would look like or how it's proposed and how it's going to be put into effect?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hanson, that is a very fair question. I mean, we can give you our best guesses at this point. We have a whole planning process we have yet to go through, and actually the cap in the governor's recommended budget was proposed to go into place next January, 6, 7, 8 months from now. And we have to also go through probably several rounds of federal approvals as well. But I think in the thinking we've done so far, we could certainly give you what we think those categories would be, absent, again, a whole planning process and the stakeholders having been involved in that.
Mr. Taves, it's almost May. Representative Hans is absolutely correct. We can't wait until later to make the decision. And so you've got the legislature that will probably be done in 2 months, maybe a month and a half.
Oh, that'd be wonderful.
And so we're going to make a decision on yes or no. And to tell you the truth, this today in our conversation is the first time that I have recognized that it wasn't an absolute cap, where if it's 21,000, then the next day somebody's in line and they don't get in until it's now 20,999 because somebody's off and somebody's going to fill in. So if there is this criteria, it is vitally important to know what your best estimate, what is your recommendation as what it should be. Please provide that to us so that we can make a rational decision as to whether or not a cap should be allowed or not, because the financial consequences either way are huge. Representative Hammond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Taves, would it also be true still that even if the cap was in place, that assuming the individual or individuals met all the requirements, you know, sort of the above-the-line requirements, that they could establish an income cap trust and then meet the requirement and come in under the cap?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hanna, no, because, again, the cap is not on eligibility.
It's just on
people that are eligible either as meeting the levels 1 through 13 or the financial eligibility, even if they've used an income cap trust, if they're above 300% of SSI, and we have, I think, about 1,000 people roughly that have income cap trusts that are slightly above that $1,600 a month. That have made themselves eligible financially through that mechanism, but that doesn't get them around the cap. They're eligible, and technically, well, more than technically, they're eligible for the mandatory service, which is nursing home services. But they wouldn't get under the cap because the cap again is on entrance into program, not eligibility.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. So it's not on a budgetary number. It's on a total number of people within the cap.
Right.
It's a count. It's a head count in a sense.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hanna, more or less, and the reason I say that, the numbers will change again as we come into rebalance and reshoot because the caseload numbers are, and of course when we made the budget recommendations way back, we were projecting a certain caseload number where the cap would be set, and that itself will change. But we had estimated in the original budget that 700-plus clients would not be served over time as a result of the cap. But again, the cap is not an absolute cap. The cap always assumes that people die, there's turnover in our system, people move away or leave services for other reasons. So there's always some capacity within that cap, which, of course, we have to have because if you shut it all down and people go straight into nursing facilities, the costs are in the stratosphere at that point.
Okay, and there's just a clarification also, and that is that even if the cap is in place, if you qualify, you can go to a nursing home facility. And so this is actually a calculated risk that a large number of people who would not be able to come into normal long-term care because of the cap would elect to go into a nursing home at a much, much higher cost. And so it's kind of uncharted waters there. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. It's walking a very fine line between opening access to people who otherwise would be most at risk of going into nursing facilities. And the real impact is it slows down your entrance into your in-home program, probably to some degree to assisted living, and your higher impairment levels. It's not going to slow down access all that much because they are the people that would ultimately locate in nursing facilities if they have no other service.
There is
Senator Bates and then Representative Hanna.
There is another factor you have to think about too, is a pushback on the other direction. People who would be eligible for at-home care and their other option is to go into a nursing home, by and large, are not going to take that option. They don't want that option. They do not want to go to a nursing home and they'll be on this waiting list. One of the real questions for me is when we haven't got answered and we've been asking for, I'm not sure you can predict this, is what's that waiting list going to look like? I would look on a waiting list as 2 months, 3 months, 6 months, a month, a year, 2 years. And we have waiting lists in other programs, you know, HUD and whatnot. And some of us, I think, could find it acceptable to have a waiting list that wasn't too long and for people at a level of care where we don't want them to deteriorate to the point they end up in a nursing home. But we need to know what that waiting list looks like. The ones you're talking about here are people who have probably come out of a hospital setting and probably wouldn't be going to in-home care anyway. They'd probably be going to a nursing home. You have to have capacity to open that up. What you're worried about is people saying, I think I could have stayed at home, but now I need to go to a nursing home, and we have to take them to a nursing home. But I think people, for most individuals, are not wanting to take that option unless they absolutely have to. They want to stay home. They want to stay in their own environment. And they don't want to go to a nursing home. They might go to an ALF. They might go to residential care. They might go to foster care. But they don't want to go to a nursing home. That's a very different environment and one they don't want to go to. And those of us who've gone to those places, I mean, they do the best they can there, but it's not where people like to be. So there's that pushback also.
It also might be a situation where if the cap were to go into place, that OPI would need to be given additional funds to help people stay in their homes that otherwise you know, might shift. I don't know on that part. Representative Hannah and then Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess the question begs as well, of the people that are qualified, that qualified based on an income cap trust, those folks probably would be less likely to take the nursing home option that you're talking about. I wonder what percentage of the qualified folks would fall under that category, that they put themselves within an income cap trust. Because they probably would not be the ones that would go to nursing homes because they probably could arrange it differently.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hannah, I'm not sure I can... We can probably give you the best estimate on that, but I think you're correct. I doubt that those individuals would be most likely to.
Yeah.
And I think Senator Bates is absolutely right. Most people will resist that choice, and really what you're talking about is decreases in a person's quality of life. I mean, they're struggling with less supports and probably more accelerating the time in the future where they'll need more expensive services because we didn't provide services at the front end. And in response to your comment, Mr. Chairman, I mean, we actually, in an early stage of the budget, and that's how we got into this problem with OPI, we actually increased our proposed allocation for OPI up to $15 million as kind of a little safety valve here so people get just a little bit while they were waiting. And then as we couldn't get to our general fund target, that's where the mistake got made because we cut from 15 down to the MOE level, which was 11 million, when in fact we only had 8.1 in the program to begin with. So that's how we got into that. But we're very cognizant, and if, to the degree we could provide some kind of at least minimal support to people while they're waiting, that would be, and that would help maintain the cap. But again, the cap seems kind of a cruel, heartless thing, but when you're looking at choices or reductions, from our perspective, it's better to slow down people coming in than throwing people in service, out of service. I mean, that is so untenable, and it was so difficult to do last biennium. So of our sort of grim choices, this was a more attractive of those choices, if you want to call it that.
Mr. Chair? Did you stop the comment?
Yeah. Well, a question, and maybe we'll be getting to this at a later point. But if we've identified a savings of $7.6 million that we've identified as a savings in biennium by implementing the cap?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Okay, and yet we don't know what the criteria is going to be for people that will be accepted from the cap. How realistic is that $7.6 million in terms of actual savings? If we don't know whether it's going to be a 2-month waiting cap, I guess at some point I need to know how viable that number is. I mean, if we can work around the cap through a criteria of, and that hasn't been figured into the 7.6, I mean, there's a point where it gets down to, is it worth doing at all? Have you already thought that maybe 40% of the potential clients are going to be eligible for services anyway, and that's been figured into how you came up with the $7.6 million?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, I can go back and calculate exactly how we came up with the 7.6, but that number is going to change substantially when we come into the governor's reshoot because the caseloads have changed pretty remarkably since that time. And I think Mr. Britton indicated earlier that $30 or $40 million came out of SPD's budget during the last biennium, and at least a good part of that was because of caseloads trending down. And after we did the big reductions, I think that slowed down the growth significantly. But we're starting to see caseloads trend back up, and so we're going to have to reproject that in the cap. But I guess my answer is we will have to balance to the dollar amount. We'll have to set the cap criteria based on the amount of allocation within the cap that we think we have revenue for. And so the waiting list could go up or down depending on that dollar amount.
Senator,
James, it seems to me the key question here is how long these folks, I mean, given the Hobson's choice here, the key question is these folks are on the waiting list. And so kind of two questions, I guess a statement really, is will your report back to us give us any indication of how long some of these folks are going to have to wait? And if there's, quote, only 7.6 million worth of savings, that would imply to me that the cap is set high enough that just through the normal rotation of people coming off eligible services that the waiting list isn't very long. Is that a fair assessment at this juncture?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Westland, no, I'm not sure that's a fair assessment. I think the waiting list could be quite long. Again, depending on where we end up with our caseload projections for next biennium, where we set the cap, and the amount of estimated revenue within that cap, we're going to have to spread that out and look at what our capacity really is and what number of people we can admit over what periods of time that we have the revenue for. So, I mean, that's kind of the balancer. The waiting list could end up being quite long. But, again, you're always taking a calculated risk there because that person can immediately go into the most expensive
right.
part of the service system. So you're always triaging against that eventuality.
Okay.
But Mr. Chairman, I mean, we can come back on Monday. I mean, we've done some thinking about this. Like I said, we've not gone through a formal planning process, but we can give you at least our best initial thoughts on what the criteria on the cap are going to be.
That'll help.
Okay.
Okay, I'd like to bring up one other thing. We had talked briefly about could there be a change, instead of just having a cap, could there be a change as of January 1st to a lesser amount? And the answer was no. And I want to proceed with that and ask, you know, why or what would it take to do that? Supposing that there was a decision that $1,600 a month is not, or it could be cut back, could be to a lower level, could we grandfather the current population, the current people that are clients as of the end of this year, and then shift to 100% of SSI and have it be an open population but at a lower financial level?
Mr. Chairman, I think we have pursued those questions with the federal government so many different times, and the answer always comes back no, that your eligibility is your eligibility. You cannot sort of do subcaps, and you can't grandfather. I mean, one of the biggest problems states have faced in reducing long-term care budgets is they don't allow you to grandfather, because if you say this person who otherwise would be coming into service looks identical to someone who's in a 24-hour care setting here, the eligibility has to be the same. So if you're going to cut this person off, you have to throw this person out. And that's been the complexity of trying to align this budget with revenues. But having said that, I think we'll look at resources as part of the risk criteria, not as part of the eligibility criteria. But even resources really depend. If you have a person with a modest disability who has much less income, and they have some family supports, that's very different than someone who may get $1,600 a month but have extraordinarily complex needs and have no family at all. So resources in and of itself is a factor, but it's not the determining factor. It's the mix of resources and family availability and all of those other things.
Okay, so what would keep us from being a little bit creative in the way that we approached it and recognizing that lowering to 100% but providing supplemental funds or assistance to those that are already in the program that can't qualify? In other words, we can grandfather through the way that we structure it in the state, but have a change across the board as far as the qualification. We have an increasing population. You were kind at the very beginning when you said we're going to have to see how we fill the hole. But the hole cannot be filled if you project it out. there is not enough money to do that and still have education and prisons and so forth. So we do have a system that is broken. It's just not, it's not terminal today. It may be 10 years, it may be 12 years, but we know we cannot continue. And so if one of the things that could be done would be to change from a 300% to 100% and have legislation which would provide funds to enable or, you know, to make up the difference or do what we need to do to help those that are currently in the system stay in the system. I mean, has that been discussed? In other words, not just A or B, but possibly a hybrid.
Mr. Chairman, again, I think in all of our investigation on different alternatives, the answer to that has always been no. You cannot create differential criteria for eligibility. Again, you can bring risk criteria to bear on when the person enters, and I think you can look at resources as part of that risk, but you can't create subcaps. And having said that, everybody, the National Governors Association, the National Conference of State Legislatures, all the National Medicaid Directors, everybody has said that the federal Medicaid program in long-term care needs to be completely revamped. And we've been saying that for years. I mean, the rules do not simply, they simply do not apply given what's happening now and certainly given the demographic. And but barring that, we move within a very tight box here. We're willing to pursue any avenue that would protect people currently in services and be fair to people at risk that are coming in. But creating those sort of sub-eligibility caps has not been permitted so far.
Okay, thank you. Representative Henson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not going to dwell on this very long, but when we say that the gaps can't be filled, they probably can't if you're, well, you could fill them with increased revenue on cigarette tax, on minimum corporation taxes. There's lots of ways to fill the gap, so I don't think it's unfair to say that the gap can't be filled. The other thing, I think, as we look in the long, if we're wanting to look long term, we have to be very careful in terms of, it's hard to, if we only look at demographics of aging and income levels and stuff, as this next group of people enter this age group that we're concerned with, I think there's going to be some incredible changes in the dynamics of either how they get their care, their health level, their ability to stay active longer. I mean, it's going to be incredibly complicated in terms to project out what the needs are. And I think there's lots of different ways to fill that gap other than saying, you know, with our very traditional programs that we're providing service with today, that's how we're going to be doing it 10 years from now.
That's right.
But I think there's either ways to fill the gap or there are ways to keep the gap from occurring. But it's not going to be based on doing the same things we're doing today, which, again, the changes from the federal programs, too, will hopefully accommodate that.
Correct.
Also.
Further comments or questions? Continue. Thanks.
Mr. Chairman, the last point about the box I was going to make is, I mean, those were the issues we looked at, but we had several other things in terms of that box as well. We've now placed nursing facility rates and the methodology by which we calculate those rates in statute, and we do collective bargaining now for the home care program, and we have much of the developmental disability system tied up in the Staley agreement. So, again, that just sort of draws the picture of the limitations that we have in approaching reduction scenarios. What I'd like to do is move on a bit to the home care program. We had a very initial discussion in phase one about the home care program and potentially restructuring the home care program. And we've talked about the whole concept of agency with choice. And I want to expand upon that a little bit because I think there's been a lot of information about that in this building. At the end of phase one, I think Representative Hanna sort of crystallized the four or five or six things that really are problematic in the home care program in terms of the employer-employee relationship that is so non-traditional. and looking at issues around particularly worker injury and redeployment and early return to work and all of those issues, which are absolutely necessary to contain workers' compensation costs in a completely non-traditional employer-employee relationship, are very difficult to achieve. And so by introducing a different way of approaching this program, which has been quite controversial and has created a lot of fears, our goal, and we've now done several things. We took a team, we went to three different states, we looked at agency with choice models, where the client truly employs their home care worker, but the agency wraps around all kinds of supports in that employer-employee relationship in a co-employment kind of relationship where both the client and an agency are co-employers. And none of the models really fit Oregon, and they have their pros and cons, but we've tried to lift some of the best ideas, and we're now looking at those. And fairly soon we'll have a major discussion, and we'll start costing out what those models could look like. Our goal in trying to not so much reduce the costs of the home care program as contain costs in the out years, because with workers' compensation, obviously, the tail goes out at least 10 years. But is to look where we maintain the collective bargaining agreements and the process for this group of workers. We still preserve the right of the client to employ a home care worker of their choice within limits that would be defined as pre-qualifications and pre-screening kind of criteria for new workers. And we would have to set rules to do that, and that would be part of what an agency management would do. Our goal would be that any client could walk in the door and say, I want Aunt Rose to be my home care worker, and that we would honor that in every way possible within limits again. If it's clear that Aunt Rose doesn't have the skills or the physical abilities to do heavy lifting or to do the type of care that otherwise could either hurt the client or end up hurting the worker, then we would have to say, no, we want to honor your choice, but this person that you absolutely want simply doesn't fit the bill. So that's the kind of proposal. We would look at collectively bargaining the wages and the benefits. We would pass that on in a contract with an agency. The agency potentially would then take on the workers' compensation experience as their own experience rating, unemployment insurance, et cetera. We would no longer do that at the state level. But that was the whole background behind this proposal. It was not to take collective bargaining rights away or to strip clients of their choice of their home care workers.
I understand all that you've said, but I think that there was a $9 million savings, and from what you've said, I'm not sure. How does that generate a $9 million savings in the next biennial?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think they were, number one, they would have been difficult savings to achieve, quite frankly, and the costs were based on certain staff functions currently done by workers in our field would be shifted. For example, we have clerks that do all of the vouchers for the pay and the payroll and that type of thing, and obviously if we weren't doing that, that would be shifted to home care agency. We would still retain, we would not transfer the case management. The case manager still has to do eligibility, the initial care plan, authorize the hours, but it would be a transition in staff costs, and we believe that hopefully we could bring down to some degree both the workers' compensation and the unemployment costs.
But you're actually saying that you're going to reduce staff, I mean, to save money, that means that they're no longer employed, so you'll be laying off staff that currently are doing that kind of work?
Well, we don't have a proposal at this point in time, and we have not gone through any negotiations, and we've had very initial discussions with the union that is very concerned about this, and we're not targeting any group of staff. All I'm saying is to get to a $9 million figure, it was a mixture of shifted staff costs plus a slight reduction in workers' compensation and unemployment insurance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On that $9 million assumption, what was the, or savings, what was the assumption based on how long it would take in order to work out the administrative rules and issue the contracts and actually get a system like that in place? Was that based on having it up, obviously not by July, but by next January or a year from July, or what?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, I mean, that's exactly the right question, because in our original projections, we looked at and making the entire shift by January of 06, which I think would be, number one, virtually impossible. You couldn't migrate 12,000 workers to a different structure in that kind of time period. Plus, we will have other collective bargaining issues when you apply new qualifications or pre-screening to existing workers that typically ends up being an issue of mandatory collective bargaining. It's different for new workers, so we're going to have to look at some relationship between new people coming in and how long it takes for existing workers to rotate through the system over time. And we're trying to lay all of that out and then really look more at a phase-in approach, depending on the model that ultimately we pick. Mr. Chairman, moving on very quickly on Staley. The Staley agreement is preserved, but to achieve some savings, we propose to delay enrollments. We did this in the 2001-2003 biennium, where we actually stopped enrollments for a period of time, which would have thrown us into breach of the agreement. But during that time, we then renegotiated a resettlement agreement with the plaintiffs. But now we're projecting that for the next biennium, we'll still serve 1,000 clients in support services and about 130 clients in non-crisis comprehensive care. But more and more of those numbers are delayed into the second year of the biennium to achieve some savings for this budget. Also, within the existing budget, we're creating some different benefit levels within the $20,000 uppermost cap, which is established under the legal agreement. For the most part, we have said that a person's benefit level is capped at no more than $800 a month. Most of the cases and costs come in well below that, but you have certain individuals whose needs far exceed that, and it's been virtually impossible between the initial cap and the $20,000 benefit for them to get access to services, and in many cases throws them into crisis. So we're trying to introduce an interim benefit in between there that I think will better sync up with the legal settlement. But again, that's how we achieved some savings for the biennium in delaying enrollments into the second year.
Mr. Chairman, come in.
Sure, Representative Butler.
Thank you. Have the Staley plaintiffs weighed in on this proposal?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Buckley, yes, we've had several meetings with them, and I think we're okay. I mean, they would have to speak for themselves, but I think we've told them in terms of the overall numbers, we still intend to honor our commitment to serve those number of individuals with some delays later into the biennium. So I think it's okay. Mr. Chairman, moving on to the assisted living reductions, you've heard a lot about this. And what the budget proposal does is basically align the rates for assisted living, residential care, and foster care in the same payment schedule. And so where we started out with sort of average payments for assisted living at $1,635, average for commercial foster care at about $1,046, where we would end up under these rate reductions is foster care and the assisted living rates would end up somewhere between $1,100 a month and $1,200 per month.
Can you explain to us how these figures were reached? I mean, have you benchmarked with other states? Was it strictly a financial decision? How did we come up with the numbers?
Mr. Chairman, it was mostly a financial decision. I would say this is a reduction that has showed up in previous biennia. It does represent about a 25-30% rate reduction for assisted living. I think Oregon notably tried to incentivize the assisted living movement, and that's, of course, a lot of the criticism about this reduction is that we did that. We've been very successful in putting together a very good program of assisted living across the state. And the legislature did impose a moratorium to stop the spiraling growth of these facilities, and I think there's been only 20 or 23 facilities, new ones, that have come online, so I think we've stabilized that. But primarily it was a financial decision, and the fact that, in effect, people in assisted living, I mean, we're paying a bit extra for the better features, which is mainly privacy. People get their own apartments, they get their own private space, which is what folks want, and you and I would probably want the same thing. And so we're paying for that, and that's good in that sense that we're offering a choice, but it is a slightly higher rate for people that otherwise with the same acuity levels are served in residential care or in foster care. As you know, Mr. Chairman, there's a lot of anxiety at, in terms of those facilities where the state has underwritten the mortgage. We have about 43 that Housing and Community Services funded under general obligation bonds, and they're predicting that probably at least half could be at significant risk of failure if this reduction goes forward. Mr. Chairman, in relative foster care, I know we've talked about that. That program is...
Okay, if... How valid do you think that projection that half would go into financial failure if the rate decrease is implemented?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, I think it's fairly valid. I don't think we really question that at all. And particularly when you look at smaller facilities that have a high percentage of Medicaid beds that are probably at the margins already, if you slice that margin even deeper, it really does put them at risk. So we have not really disputed that would be the eventual impact. Now, within sort of half of those, the 20 or so, I think about 15 or 16 people are predicting would go down. They simply could not survive. And then you have another group that would really be at the margins, and no one knows for certain, but they certainly would be at risk.
Mm-hmm. Even now, if we're talking about the ones that the state has a financial interest in terms of underwriting or guaranteeing the mortgages, How many other facilities would be at risk that we're not financially involved with, or do those have a different client mix?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, not really, and I think we actually have a chart that shows facilities, number of beds that are Medicaid, and so you can sort of go up and down and clearly look at either high vacancy rates or a small facility to begin with high Medicaid usage where this rate reduction really would hit hard, and they have a lesser amount of people in private pay. I think probably Mr. Carlson and Oka could give you a harder analysis of the other facilities that they think would be at risk.
Okay. So is it fair to say that this cut will really destabilize that portion of the continuum?
Mr. Chairman, it's certainly part of the portfolio. Absolutely. It will destabilize, and there certainly will be some facilities that will close.
Thank you. 25 to 30% reduction in your gross income could have, assuming that what the client mix is, it might have a problem with your bottom line.
Yeah.
Do you know how many facilities there are roughly? You said 43 are state funded, but how many facilities are we talking about that are assisted living?
Mr. Chairman, 238?
192.
I apologize. 192.
Okay, got it. Thank you.
Depends on which book you're looking at.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, moving on to the relative foster care reduction. As you know, the governor's recommended budget eliminates relative foster care for about 1,900 individuals where relatives support these individuals in their own home. The average payments have been about $850 a month. We predict about 40% of this population will still be categorically eligible, and eligible probably for both the Oregon Health Plan, and if you're categorically eligible, you're eligible for 20 hours of personal care. So there would be at least some service for a group of those individuals, then we've predicted another percentage, 20 or 30%, would actually come back into other service settings over the course of the biennium. We're concerned about this. I think as we've looked at this reduction and have talked to some degree with our attorneys, that if the person with a disability or the elder living in a relative's home gets themselves on the rental agreement or the lease, they probably could declare that that's their own home and then be eligible for the in-home program, and for the relative to convert to a home care worker then whether or not that would end up being a cost shift into a different program versus simply relatives struggling to make do with less support from the state, I think is uncertain. But we've at least tried to predict that certain people will be categorically eligible, still receive some services, and others then will come back over the course of the biennium into the rest of our service system. Mr. Chairman, we've delayed cost of living adjustments in this budget for the first 6 months of the biennium, and then after that for 2005 through 6 and 05, 07, we have the standard inflationary factors of 1.5%, 1.9%. This was an area that we debated at length during our budget preparation, whether we should take cost of living adjustments out completely, but recognizing that many of our community providers and our nonprofits have gone without cost of living adjustments for almost 4 years now, as their costs have significantly increased, we felt would so destabilize the industry. And the other factor here, again, outside of nursing facilities and collective bargaining for home care workers, most of the rest of the programs often are nonprofits, operate already at the margins, and their biggest costs are staffing costs. And some years ago, the legislature set direct care wages in at least some of the programs at $3 or $4 above minimum wage, so there was always an edge there. But now, as we've indexed minimum wage and we've sort of capped or not increased the differential for many of our community workers, that's starting to catch up, and we're very concerned at a point in time where that intersects and the economy is robust again, we could go back to some of the turnover rates and vacancy rates that were just horrific. I mean, for periods of time in homes serving people with severe disabilities, we had turnover rates of 150% or more a year, and again, with a severe disability population and that kind of turnover, it's a dangerous mix. So we were very committed to at least protecting cost of living at least for 18 months of the biennium. Mr. Chairman, the reduction in the Children's Intensive In-Home Program, and there was an error in this, so it will have to be corrected in the reshoot, but originally we were calculating a savings because much of the service that kids in this program get, and for the most part these are technology-dependent kids, ventilator-dependent kids that are served in their own homes. We pay for nursing and other support services that go into that home and allow the family to provide a portion of the care, but certainly allow the child to be at home as opposed to, in fact, many of these kids would not even qualify for skilled nursing care. If they weren't at home, they would probably be in a hospital setting or an intensive care setting. But for many of these families, in our original budget projections, we didn't adequately estimate the amount that their private insurance would still cover the private duty nursing. And so we had some savings there of about $1.4 million that was originally calculated in the governor's recommended budget. That was double counted, and we're going to have to adjust that in the reshoot. Mr. Chairman, I've already talked about Oregon Project Independence and how we got to being in the hole when we were originally committed to covering the maintenance of effort, so I won't go into any more detail there. Let me skip, Mr. Chairman, to page 17. I'm just trying to pick out the highlights here. On page 17, for people that are OSIP eligible, and these are people that are SSI eligible, for whom the state also provides $1.70 a month, $20 and something a year as part of our maintenance of effort. they're also eligible for special needs payments. And for many individuals, even who are not in our service system but are living at home on their own and are quite poor, they have access to certain special needs payments if they need special accommodations because of their disability, for example, that will allow them to still live in their home or apartment. Will help fund that. In some cases, will help with utilities and other things that allow them to stay in their own home. We've significantly decreased the access to that program. Or starting last biennium, we took a series of actions that tightened the criteria for that. And you'll see on page 18 now that whereas several years ago we were running at about $384,000 a month in special need payments, that's now down to about $209,000 a month. So that was one of the administrative actions we took to achieve savings. Mr. Chairman, moving on to the General Assistance Program. The GA program was cut in the last budget cycle. It was then restored by the legislature for people that were only estimated to be SSI eligible, not potentially eligible for Social Security disability income. We originally projected we would serve about 1,100 clients over the biennium, and that actually is coming at a much lower amount. This is a program for the very, very poor who are awaiting eligibility determination for SSI. We give a cash payment about $314 a month, and then access to the Oregon Health Plan, and in some cases, even though they're waiting for full eligibility for SSI to be determined, will authorize their entrance into long-term care as well if they meet the service priority levels of 1 through 13. That program...
When you say they're waiting for SSI, then when SSI comes through, my recollection is that there's a lump sum payment for the duration. Is there a reimbursement from SSI?
Mr. Chairman, correct. We go in and we recover then the lump sum and offset it against what we've paid out.
So with the offsets, and this is not a very expensive program?
Well, it still is. I'm trying to think. Look at the dollar amount that it was reduced by.
Does anyone have it?
4.9 million.
And really, Mr. Chairman, the differential cost is the offsets can be used against the direct payment or benefits the person has gotten, not the staffing costs of running the program. We cannot use the offsets to offset those costs. So that really is the general fund contribution that has to be made in addition to what we get back in lump payments. So some people ultimately turn out not to be eligible, and then we have to cover the staffing costs in excess of that.
If this program did not exist today and we had an extra $5 million, would we create this program? I mean, are these needs being met? Can they be met through other resources that are currently available, or is this really a mistake to be done?
Yeah. Well, Mr. Chairman, it's a difficult cut. You're cutting resources to very, very poor people. So is it a mistake? I mean, we're making reductions in some difficult areas given the revenue issues that we face. But that will pose a great hardship for some very, very poor individuals. And some of them we will still have to say they're presumptively eligible and still eligible for the Oregon Health Plan and other things, because if they come through our doors and sort of present themselves as being disabled, we have to do a presumptive eligibility. So some will still be eligible for some benefits, but the cash payment that sort of tied them over while they're waiting for full SSI eligibility will not be there.
Okay, Representative Hanson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I see this program as critically important, not so much in terms of the dollars that are granted, but it becomes the portal for people to get Oregon Health services, or if you're talking about using those dollars so that somebody can get into some housing program, we for those of us that were on public safety, that when we toured the women's prison, one of the biggest concerns there is women leaving the prison system that are mentally ill. The lag time from from the time that they apply for disability until they receive it, and the interruption in meds. But you just raised an interesting point. You said that presumptive eligibility for disabled people. In the health plan, we've got tied to this savings. We've got the 4.9 and to savings and general assistance, and then there's still another $7 or $8 million, I believe, in the health plan, because of benefits that people wouldn't be receiving if they weren't on general assistance. But yet, you're saying that, like with good casework, if the caseworkers were accepting them as being presumptively eligible, would those savings disappear?
Some, Mr. Chairman, probably would. And as the standard program has gone away, originally a lot of these people would have just gone in potentially into standard, but as that program has disappeared and as the general assistance program has disappeared and as people present themselves as presumptively eligible, yes, they may well qualify for the Oregon Health Plan, and that may reduce some potential savings on that side, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And then, could you explain to me again where the $4.9 million in savings come? I mean, if we're reimbursed, obviously there may be some people that Social Security eventually says aren't eligible, and so we'd be on the hook for those dollars. Where's the rest of the cost incurred? Staffing,
most of it's staffing costs, Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen.
Okay.
I have a question on that as well, and maybe our fiscal folks can help us. If you're looking at this document, the 0305 number here is 3.818. Am I looking at the right budget number there for the general assistance?
That's right. Mm-hmm.
So the 4.9 was the requested amount for the program? Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen, the 4.9 would have included the general fund for these particular grants, but as James Tave said, I would imagine that the rest of it is in staffing costs.
CSL?
Correct.
That's right.
So that the balance should be in the staffing, in the program support.
Well, follow up, please. If you look at the total fund for the 0305 of 3.8, and then you go to the 4.9, you know, we were shooting for just under a 30% increase here. Is that right? Am I understanding that correctly?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen, I'm not sure of that. I don't think that we were shooting for a larger increase. There may have been some increases as a result of a caseload change.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hannah and Mr. Britton is absolutely correct. We gave up quite a few savings in the general fund for this program because the caseloads had come in much lower than originally projected. But as we costed it for the next biennium, originally we thought it would be about 1,100 clients. It ended up only being about 400 clients, and we projected it would rise up to about 700 clients, I believe, by next biennium. So it was much higher, came way down, and then we titrated it up to...
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Even on the caseload issue, tell me if I'm wrong, but my perception would be if somebody was pretty severely disabled, came in to a DHS office or a AAA office, were perceived to be eligible for SSI, and maybe needed Oregon Health Plan assistance, those types of things. Even if they weren't eligible for direct assistance, wouldn't there also be a significant caseload? I mean, they're going to have to be interviewed. They're going to have to be determined whether they're eligible for other programs. I mean, where's the savings in terms of administration costs? I mean, are we talking about the? I wouldn't think the cost of cutting the check are that high, but the case management and stuff involved with the people that are potentially eligible for this program are still going to exist, aren't they? They're still going to be eligible for food stamps. They're still going to be eligible for. They're going to be case managed.
And Mr. Chairman, our field is very worried that by cutting the general assistance program, it's going to increase the pressure on caseloads that are pretty high in other areas already. I mean, that's a clear concern.
So, is there really $4 million worth of savings there, or $5 million?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, well, there is if we take it out of the budget and don't mitigate other staffing impacts. But I mean,
do we deal with it in a reshoot or a rebalance in 6 months in another area?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, I mean, that really is a policy call because we have all kinds of caseload issues that are coming to roost here, including MMA, including presumptive eligibility, and, you know, we're trying to sort through all that right now in the reshoot, and particularly with MMA and what people will be coming in on that side that also potentially are food stamp eligible and eligible for the health plan and other areas. We have lots of caseload issues that we're going to have to back up and sort of look at the entire program. So I can't answer that question real directly other than say that your concerns are absolutely valid. Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, the other program slated for elimination in the governor's recommended budget is the Employment Initiative Program. I can only sort of describe this as a supplemental program to vocational rehabilitation, although it's done in partner with them, where we have funded some 30 staff across the state for elders or people with disabilities that have been chronically unemployed and needed additional supports other than just short-term supports through voc rehab. And that program is scheduled for elimination.
Would you mind describing that? They're elderly and disabled, and they don't have enough support through other employment support. What type of employment support are we talking about?
Mr. Chairman, I could clearly get you detailed case examples, but typically in vocational rehabilitation, for example, they go through a period of assessment, short-term training, and then the person is expected to transition either into competitive employment or some other long-term support. On the developmental disability side, we have a lot of long-term support, either in sheltered workshops or in supported employment, et cetera. On senior and physical disability side, you did not have other long-term supports like we did on the DD side. And so this particular program provided a series of staff that would work very intensively with a person over time to help them sort out transportation and help them with interviewing and help them with job supports and a whole multitude of tasks that went beyond a core vocational rehabilitation kind of program.
Okay, thank you.
And finally, Mr. Chairman, the other program that was slated for elimination in the governor's recommended budget was the RSVP, the Retired Senior Volunteer Program, where there are federal funds to that program. The state for quite a few years has provided general fund for that program as well. It provides a lot of wonderful supports using senior volunteers and communities to students and public safety and other areas, but that's slated for elimination in this budget.
Mr. Chair. Senator Bates.
Does that eliminate the loss of general fund, eliminate the program entirely?
Mr. Chairman, I don't believe so. I think there's
federal funds.
Eliminates the general fund, but there's some percentage of federal fund in the program, but I don't know exactly what that is.
There's no maintenance of effort, no match.
I don't believe so.
We get more information about that at a later time. How much is federal funds left? And
Mr. Chairman, well, Senator Bates, we can.
It isn't listed in the information that I received yesterday.
So we can provide that information.
Thank you. President Hanna.
Mr. Chair, is that, Mr. Britton, does that fall under your report? I can't find the data.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hanna. I think I got it right that time.
Because I didn't sign it.
RSVP, as I recall, has about $275,000 general fund to begin with in the current service level, and the cut was $250,000. So I can't speak to the federal funds amount, but in my analysis, I had assumed wrongly that the program was eliminated, but it does have 25,000 left out of 275, which was in the current service level.
Thank you.
Or a coffee kiosk in Bristol.
Mr. Chairman, I thought I would return to the four program areas that you said you wanted some additional discussion on from phase one, and that included the state-operated community program for people with developmental disabilities, the Community Housing Trust Fund, the overall category of community-based care, and I'm not sure what the issues were there, but that was, again, as part of the sub-A budget category that was in the rankings, where there were some disparate scoring and then prompting additional questions. Eastern Oregon Training Center, those were the areas that we had listed from. So, Mr. Chairman, would you like me simply to try to elaborate a little bit on those areas?
Starting with state-operated community programs, we're looking at $272,000 per person, 146 people population, that's per year. So that is such a huge amount. The question comes up as to whether or not those 140 people have all been reviewed recently to determine whether or not there has been improvements in any number of them. I mean, at $540,000 a biennium, if three of them had improved in their conditions that they no longer needed that intensity of care, that's some real money. And so we had the opportunity to go to one facility and saw five individuals, and it was a very humbling sobering experience to see what those poor folks go through. And so I know that five out of 146 are where they need to be, but I'm not sure about the other 141. And so could you elaborate onto the range of severity and whether or not there are some in this population that could be in a less expensive situation than $272,000 a year?
Mr. Chairman, a couple responses to that. First of all, I think the original math that we did based on the original budget document was a bit in error, because I had indicated there were 141 clients, or actually 146, so that changes the bottom line a little bit. And on the spreadsheet here, we have a slightly different number, so we're going to have to reconcile exactly. But be that as it may, the cost is very, very high for these individuals. In the materials that we've sent over, we made several comments. Number one, we have, I think, seven or eight clients right now in this program that are being referred out that we feel can be served just as well in a nonprofit community agency somewhere else, and probably at significantly or some reduced cost. But for those individuals, we have long waiting lists of other people that are in crisis somewhere else in the system that are waiting to get in. So the problem for us in this program, again, if you looked at the profile of the individuals, for the most part, in this program, they have gone through multiple failures in many parts of the rest of our service system. And at any given time, we have a series of clients out there either with extensive medical needs or behavioral needs that are failing and need some place to go, and they sort of stack up in there. And that's why, in fact, we're trying to create turnover, to create some capacity so that the state-operated program does not become a static program just for people who left Fairview and who will live there forever, but the turnover will create, in a sense, our crisis capacity going forward.
Well, before you go there, if they're presently somewhere, are they somewhere at a cost of $270,000 or more? Or are they going to move into a very, very expensive situation when they're presently having needs met at a much cheaper expense? I mean, this is probably the most expensive single item on a per person basis that I've seen in the budget, and it was $282,000. Now it's down to $272,000 with the two numbers, or with some changes in the figures that I've been given. But So I'm not real clear on a waiting list for these kinds of services. How could you be on a waiting list for these kinds of services? Where are they at right now?
Mr. Chairman, some individuals that come into this program have come straight out of the forensic unit at Oregon State Hospital. We have an individual with developmental disability that murdered someone. We have people that have committed some significant sexual offenses that came in under the PSRB, the Psych Security Review Board, who then have done their time, are ready for release. But we believe even though they've served their time, they're not on probation or anything else, they still represent a significant risk. And so we would move an individual like that into a state-operated program. It's not locked. We would staff it very heavily to assure public safety. We have individuals that each county and region of the state has a crisis fund for people that are in crisis. So they might be in a small community program whose rates typically are at a much slower level, but that person has real significant behavior problems that have broke out. So the county or the region has greatly inflated that rate and put a one-to-one staff in for that person just to temporarily solve the problem, but it's a short-term solution, not a long-term solution. And so while that person is holding, we're searching across the state to try to find a place somewhere else where the individual could go. We have a whole variety of settings where people sort of stack up and we try to mitigate the problem at the time, but it's not a longer-term solution. And we have people that we created within state-operated itself, a five-bed crisis bed program that was originally at Eastern Oregon Training Center in Pendleton. We moved that here to the Valley, so that's intended to be a place for no more than 90 days where we can bring a person in, hopefully stabilized. But as it's turned out, some of those individuals coming in then really can't go back to the private sector, and so they would move or transition into other parts of the state-operated program.
Okay. Is there Hannah?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The tour we took and the folks that we saw here locally, none of which seemed capable to have the kind of interaction with the public that you're talking about, sex crimes, murder, those kind of things. So this population of the 146 that are in the state-operated community programs, is that a vastly different group than the few that we saw?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hanna, in the state-operated program, we have nine homes that are primarily focused on medical issues and 22 that are focused on behavior. The home you saw was a medical home here in the Salem area, but the vast majority of people served in this program really are people with extreme behaviors of one sort or another. And I think the cost distribution, I'm not sure if it's much higher.
It's within a couple of times.
It is, okay.
Hello? I guess I want to push that number thing just a little bit. 11 are medically necessary and 22? Is that
nine are medical homes and 22 are behavior homes.
Nine and 22. You would think that those that we viewed in terms of needing 24/365 care in terms of movement, turning, feeding, the number of issues versus the mental incapacities or those type of things would be somewhat less, but I have no experience with that. My question is, the cost for the nine is not substantially more than for the 22? Did I understand?
I believe it.
The cost for the nine is about $2,000 a month less than the cost for the
John is saying that the cost for the medical homes is about $2,000 a month less than for the behavior homes.
Hmm.
And in part, in the medical homes, of course, you have nursing staff, you have some other higher paid disciplines. In some of the behavior homes, you have some behavior specialists, but largely there it's a staffing cost where you're literally staffing for the public safety and the safety of the individual, where at times if they're outside the home, you have to do one-on-one or two-on-one kind of staffing ratios.
Thank you. All right. We have expired our time today. Thank you very much
for
this information, and we'll see everyone tomorrow. There's no further comments
no.
from
tomorrow.
No. Monday.
Monday.
Say is this day. We will see you Monday. And without objection, we're adjourned.